sharp enough to cause him pain. Dimly, he wondered if the pain he felt was hers. Roger?
Ah?
Are you really big, do you think?
Her voice was slightly tremulous. He groped for remnants of coherence. About the usual.
A flash of concern penetrated the feelings of drunkenness.
Am I hurting you a lot?
No, not exactly. Just... Can you not move for a minute?
A minute? An hour? All my life, if you want.
He thought it would kill him not to move, and would have died gladly. Her hands moved slowly down his back, touching his buttocks. He shivered and ducked his head, eyes closed, painting her face before his mind's eye with a dozen small and mindless kisses. "Okay," she whispered in his ear, and like an automaton he began to move as slowly as he could, restrained as he went by the pressure of her hand on his back. She stiffened very slightly and relaxed. Stiffened and relaxed. He knew he was hurting her. Did it again. He ought to stop. She lifted up against him, taking him. And there was a deep and bestial noise that he must have made. Now. It had to be now. He had to. Shaking and gasping like a landed fish, he jerked free of her body and lay on her, feeling her breasts crushed against him as he jerked and moaned. Then he lay still. No longer drunk, but wrapped in guilty peace, and felt her arms around him and the warm breath of the whisper in his ear. "I love you," she said, her voice husky in the hop-scented air. "Stay with me."
"All my life," he said, and wrapped his arms around her.
They lay peacefully together, welded with the sweat of their efforts, listening to each other breathe. Roger stirred at last, lifting his face from her hair, his limbs at once weightless and heavy as lead.
"All right, love," he whispered. "Have I hurt you?"
"Yes, but I didn't mind." Her hand passed lightly down the length of his back, making him shiver despite the heat. "Was it all right? Did I do it right?" She sounded faintly anxious.
"Oh, God."
He bent his head and kissed her, long and lingering. She tensed a bit, but then her mouth relaxed under his. "It was all right, then."
"Oh, Jesus. You certainly swear a lot for a minister's son," she said, with a faint note of accusation. "Maybe those old ladies in Inverness were right. You have gone to the devil." "Not blasphemy," he said.
He put his forehead against her shoulder, breathing in the deep, ripe scent of her, of them.
"Prayers of thanksgiving."
That made her laugh. "Oh, it was all right then," she said with an unmistakable note of relief. He lifted his head.
"Christ, yes,"
he said, making her laugh again.
"How could you possibly think otherwise?"
"Well, you didn't say anything. You just lay there like somebody'd hit you over the head. I thought maybe you were disappointed."
Now it was his turn to laugh, his face half buried in the smooth damps of her neck.
"No," he said finally, coming up for air. "Behaving as though your spinal column's been removed is a fair indication of male satisfaction. No very gentlemanlike, maybe, but honest."
"Oh, okay."
She seemed satisfied with that.
"The book didn't say anything about that, but then it wouldn't. It didn't bother with what happens afterward."
"What book is this?"
He moved cautiously, their skins separating with a noise like two strips of flypaper being parted.
"Sorry about the mess."
He groped for his wadded shirt and handed it to her.
"A sensuous man."
She took the shirt and dabbed fastidiously.
"It was a lot of stuff about ice cubes and whipped cream that I thought was pretty extreme. But it was good about how to do things like fellatio and..."
"You learned that from a book?"
Roger felt as scandalized as one of the ladies of his father's congregation.
"Well, You don't think I go around doing that with people I go out with? She sounded truly shocked in turn. They write books telling young women how to... That's terrible.
What's terrible about it? She said rather huffily. How else would I know what to do?
Roger rubbed a hand over his face, at a loss for words. If asked an hour before, he would have stoutly claimed to be in favour of sexual equality. Under the veneer of modernity, though, there was apparently enough of the Presbyterian minister's son left to feel that a nice young woman really ought to be an ignoramus on her wedding night. Manfully suppressing this Victorian notion, Roger brought a hand up over the smooth white curves of hip and flank and cupped a soft, full breast.
"Not a thing," he said. "Only," he said,
and dipped his head to touch his lips to hers.
"There's a bit more to it,"
and lightly nipped her lower lip, "than you read in books, aye." She moved suddenly, turning to bring all that long white heat against his bare skin, and he shuddered at the shock of it.
"Show me," she whispered,
and bit the lobe of his ear.
A rooster crowed somewhere nearby. Brianna woke from a light doze, berating herself for sleeping. She felt disoriented, tired enough from emotion and exertion to feel light-headed, as though she were floating a foot or two off the ground. At the same time, she didn't want to miss a moment. Roger stirred by her side, feeling her move. He groped, put an arm around her, and rolled her over, curving himself to fit behind her, knees to knees, belly to buttocks. He brushed the tangles of her hair away from his face, making little pfft noises that made her want to laugh. He'd made love to her 3 times. She was very sore and very happy. She'd imagined it 1,000 times, and been wrong every time. There wasn't any way to imagine the sheer terrifying immediacy of being taken like that, stretched suddenly beyond the limits of flesh, penetrated, rent, entered. Nor was there any way she could have imagined the sense of power in it. She had expected to be helpless, the object of desire. Instead, she had held him, felt him quiver with need, all his strength leashed for fear of hurting her. Hers to unleash as she would. Hers to touch and rouse, to call to her, to command. Nor had she ever thought such tenderness existed as when he cried out and shuddered in her arms, pressing his forehead hard against her own, trusting her with that moment when his strength turned so suddenly to helplessness.
"I'm sorry," he said softly in her ear.
"For what?"
She reached back, stroked his thigh. She could do that now. She could touch him anywhere, delighting in the textures and tastes of his body. She couldn't wait for the daylight, to see him naked.
"For this."
He made a small movement with his hand, encompassing the dark around them, the hard straw under them.
"I should have waited. I wanted it to be good for you."
"It was very good for me," she said softly.
There was a shallow groove down the side of his thigh, where the muscle was indented. He laughed, a little ruefully.
"I wanted you to have a proper wedding night, soft bed, clean sheets. It should have been better for your first time."
"I've had soft beds and clean sheets," she said, "but not this."
She turned in his arms, reached down and cupped him, that fascinating mass of changeability between his legs. He stiffened for a second in surprise, then relaxed, letting her handle him as she liked.
"It couldn't have been better," she said softly, and kissed him.
He kissed her back, slow and lazy, exploring all the depths and hollows of her mouth, letting her have his. He moaned a little, far back in his throat, and reached down to take her hand away.
"Oh, God, you're going to kill me, Bree."
"I'm sorry," she said, anxious. "Did I squeeze too hard? I didn't mean to hurt you."
He laughed at that.
"Not that, but give the poor thing a wee rest,
With a firm hand, he turned her over again, nuzzling her shoulder.
Roger?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever been so happy.
Aye. Well, that's good, then.
He sounded drowsy. Even if we don't get back, as long as we're together, I don't mind.
We'll get back.
His hand cupped her breast, gentle as seaweed coming to rest round a rock.
I told you. There's another way.
There is?
I think so.
He told her about the grimoire, the mixture of careful notes and crazed rambling, and about his own passage through the stones of Craigna Dun.
The second time I thought of you, he said softly,
and traced her features with a finger in the dark.
I lived, and I did come to the right time. But the diamond Fiona gave me was no more than a smear of lamp black in my pocket.
So it might be possible to steer somehow.
Brianna couldn't keep a hint of hope from her voice.
There might be.
He hesitated.
There was... I suppose it must have been a poem, or maybe meant to be a spell, in the book.
His hand fell away as he recited it.
I raise my athame to the north, where is the home of my power. To the west, where is the half of my soul. To the south, where is the seat of friendship and refuge. To the east, from whence rises the sun. Then I lay my blade on the altar I have made. I sit down amid three flames. Three points define a plane, and I am fixed. Four points box the earth, and mine is the fullness thereof. Five is the number of protection. Let no demon hinder me. My left hand is wreathed in gold, and holds the power of the sun. My right hand is sheathed in silver, and the moon reigns serene. I begin. Garnets rest in love about my neck. I will be faithful.
Brianna sat up, arms wrapped around her knees. She was silent for a moment.
That's nuts, she said finally.
Being certifiably insane is unfortunately no guarantee that someone is likewise wrong, Roger said dryly.
He stretched, groaning, and sat up cross-legged on the straw.
Part of it is a traditional ritual, I think, given that the tradition is ancient Celt. The bits about the directions, those are the four irts which you'll find running through Celtic legend for some way back. As for the blade, the altar and the flames, it's straight witchcraft.
She stabbed her husband through the heart and set him on fire.
She still remembered, as well as he did, the stink of petrol and burning flesh in the circle of Craigna Dun, and shivered, though it was warm in the shed.
I hope we won't be forced to find someone for a human sacrifice, Roger said, trying and failing to make a joke of it. The metal, though, and the gems. Were you wearing any jewellery when you came through, Bree?
She nodded in reply. Your bracelet, she said softly. And I had my grandmother's pearl necklace in my pocket. The pearls weren't hurt, though. They came through fine.
Pearls aren't gemstones, he reminded her. They're organic, like people.
He rubbed a hand across his face. It had been a long day, and his head was starting to throb.
Silver and gold, though. You had the silver bracelet, and the necklace has gold as well as the pearls. Ah, and your mother. She wore both silver and gold too, didn't she? Her wedding rings.
Uh-huh. But 3 points define a plane, 4 points box the earth, 5 is the number of protection.
Brianna murmured under her breath.
Could she mean that you need gemstones to do whatever she was trying to do? Are those the points?
Could be. She had drawings of triangles and pentagrams and lists of different gemstones with the supposed magical properties listed alongside. She wasn't laying out her theories in any great detail, didn't need to, since she was talking to herself. But the general notion seemed to be that there are lines of force, ley lines, she called them, running through the earth. Every now and again the lines run close to each other and sort of curl up into knots,
and wherever you get such a knot, you've got a place where time essentially doesn't exist.
So, if you step into one, you might step out again any time.
Same place, different time. And if you believe that gemstones have a force of their own, which might warp the lines a bit...
Would any gemstone do?
God knows, Roger said. But it's the best chance we have, eh?
Yes, Brianna agreed after a pause. But where are we going to find any?
She waved an arm toward the town and its harbour.
I haven't seen anything like that anywhere, in Inverness or here. I think you'd need to go to a large city, London or maybe Boston or Philadelphia. And then, how much money do you have, Roger?
I managed to get £20, and I still have most of it, but that wouldn't be nearly enough for...
That's the point, he interrupted.
I was thinking of that while you were sleeping. I think I know, where I might lay hands on one stone at least. The thing is...
He hesitated.
I'll have to go at once to find it. The man who has it is in New Bern right now, but he won't be there for long. If I take a bit of your money, I can get a boat in the morning and be in New Bern by the next day. I think it's best you stay here, though, then...
I can't stay here.
Why not?
He reached for her, groping in the dark.
I don't want you with me. Or rather, I do, he corrected himself. But I think it's a lot safer for you here.
I don't mean I want to come with you. I mean I can't stay here, she repeated, although she grasped his groping hand.
She had nearly forgotten, but now all the excitement of discovery flooded back again.
Roger, I found him. I found Jamie Fraser.
Fraser? Where? Here?
He turned toward the door, startled.
No, he's in Cross Creek, and I know where he'll be on Monday. I have to go, Roger. Don't you understand? He's so close, and I've come so far.
She wanted suddenly and irrationally to weep with the thought of seeing her mother again.
Aye, I see.
Roger sounded faintly anxious.
Could you not wait a few days? It's only a day or so by sea to New Bern, the same back, and I think I can manage what I have to do within a day or two.
No, she said. I can't. There's Lizzie.
Who's Lizzie?
My maid. You saw her.
She was going to hit you with a bottle.
Brianna grinned at the memory.
Lizzie's very brave.
Aye, I dare say, Roger said dryly. Be that as it may.
But she's sick, Brianna interrupted him. Didn't you see how pale she is? I think it's malaria. She has horrible fevers and chills that last for a day or so and then stop. And a few days later, they're back again.
I have to find my mother as soon as I can.
I have to.
She could feel him struggling, choking back arguments. She reached out in the darkness and stroked his face.
I have to, she repeated softly,
and felt him surrender.
All right, he said. All right. I'll come to join you as soon as maybe. Do me the one favour, though, I wear a bloody dress.
You don't like my breeches? Laughter fizzed up like the bubbles in carbonated soda, then stopped abruptly as something occurred to her.
Roger, she said, what are you going to do? Are you going to steal this stone?
Yes,
he said simply. She was quiet for a minute, her long thumb rubbing slowly over the palm of his hand.
Don't, she said at last, very quietly. Don't do it, Roger.
Don't trouble yourself over the man who's got it.
Roger reached for her, trying to reassure her.
It's odds on he stole it from someone else.
It's not him I'm worried about. It's you.
Oh, I'll be all right,
he assured her with casual bravado.
Roger, they hang people in this time for stealing.
I won't be caught.
His hand sought hers in the darkness, found it, and squeezed.
I'll be with you before you know it.
But it isn't...
It will be all right, he said firmly. I said I would take care of you, aye? I will.
But... He rose up on one elbow and silenced her with his mouth. Very slowly, he brought her hand toward him, pressed it between his legs. She swallowed, the hairs on her arms rising suddenly with anticipation. "Mmm," he murmured against her mouth, and without waiting for an answer, pulled her down on the straw and rolled onto her, nudging her legs apart with his knee. She gasped and bit his shoulder when he took her, but he made no sound.
"Do you know," Roger said sleepily some time later, "I think I've just married my great-aunt 6 times removed. I've only just thought."
"You what?"
"Don't worry. It's nowhere close enough to be incest," he assured her.
"Oh, good," she said, with a certain amount of sarcasm. "I was really worried about that. How can I be your great-aunt, for heaven's sake?"
"Well, as I said, I just thought. I hadn't realised it before. But your father's uncle was Dougal Mackenzie, and it was him that caused all the trouble by getting a child on Geely Duncan, aye?"
It was the unsatisfactory method of contraception he had been forced to adopt that had caused him to think of it, in fact, but he thought it more tactful not to mention that. Neither shirt was fit to be worn by now. All things considered, he supposed it was just as well that Dougal Mackenzie hadn't had his sense of conscientiousness, since that would effectively have prevented Roger's own existence.
"Well, I don't think it was all his fault." Brianna sounded pleasantly drowsy as well. It couldn't be much off dawn. Birds were already making noises outside, and the air had changed, growing fresher as the wind came in off the harbour.
"So if Dougal is my great-uncle and you're 6 times great-grandfather..." "No, you're wrong. I'm about your 6th or 7th cousin, not your aunt."
"No, that would be right if we were in the same generation of descent, but we're not. You're up about 5, on your father's side at least."
Brianna was silent, trying to work this out in her head. Then, giving up, she rolled over with a faint groan, nestling her bottom snugly into the hollow of his thighs.
"The hell with it," she said. "As long as you're sure it's not incest."
He clasped her to his bosom, but his sleepy brain had grasped the point and wouldn't let it go.
"I really hadn't thought of it," he marvelled. "You know what it means, though. I'm related to your father, too. In fact, I suppose he's my only living relation besides you."
Roger felt thoroughly nonplussed by this discovery and rather moved. He had long since reconciled himself to having no close family at all. Not that a 7 times great-uncle was all that close, but...
"No, he isn't," Brianna mumbled.
"What?"
"Not the only one. Jenny, too. And her kids. And grandkids. My Aunt Jenny's your... Maybe you're right after all. 'Cause if she's my aunt, she's your umpty-great-aunt, so maybe I'm your... Gah!"
She let her head loll back against Roger's shoulder, the spill of her hair soft against his chest.
"Who would you tell them you were?"
"Who?"
"Jenny and Ian," she shifted, stretching. "When you went to Lallybroch."
"Never been there."
He shifted too, fitting his body to hers. His hand settled in the dip of her waist, and he sank back into drowsiness, giving up the abstract complexities of genealogical calculation for more immediate sensations.
"No, but then..."
Her voice died away. Fogged with sleep and the exhaustion of pleasure, Roger paid no attention, only snuggling closer with a luxurious moan. A moment later, her voice sliced through his personal fog like a knife through butter.
"How did you know where I was?" she said.
She twisted suddenly, leaving him with empty arms, and a pair of dark eyes a few inches from his own, slanted with suspicion.
"How did you know where I was?" she repeated slowly, each word a splinter of ice. "How did you know I'd gone to the colonies?"
Why?
Much too late, he woke to the realization of his danger.
"You didn't have any way of knowing I'd left Scotland," she said, "unless you went to Lallybroch, and they told you where I was going. But you've never been to Lallybroch."
I...
He groped frantically for an explanation, any explanation, but there was none other than the truth. And from the stiffening of her body, she had deduced that, too.
"You knew," she said.
Her voice wasn't much above a whisper, but the effect was as great as if she'd shouted in his ear.
"You knew, didn't you?"
She was sitting up now, looming over him like one of the Erinyces.
"You saw that death notice. You already knew. You knew all the time, didn't you?"
"No," he said, trying to gather his scattered wits. "I mean, yes, but
how long have you known? Why didn't you tell me?" she cried.
She stood up and snatched at the pile of clothes under them.
"Wait," he pleaded. "Bree, let me explain." "Yeah, explain. I want to hear you explain."
Her voice was ragged with fury, but she did stop her rummaging for a moment, waiting to hear.
"Look."
He was up himself by now.
"I did find it, last spring, but I..."
He took a deep breath, searching desperately for words that might make her understand.
"I knew it would hurt you. I didn't want to show it to you because I knew there was nothing you could do. There was no point in you breaking your heart for the sake of..."
"What do you mean there's nothing I could do?" She jerked a shirt over her head and glared toward him, fists clenched.
"You can't change things, Bree. Don't you know that? Your parents tried. They knew about Culloden, and they did everything they possibly could have to stop Charles Stuart, but they couldn't, could they? They failed. Gillis Duncan tried to make Stuart a king. She failed. They all failed."
He risked a hand on her arm. She was stiff as a statue.
"You can't help them, Bree," he said more quietly. "It's part of history. It's part of the past. You're not from this time. You can't change what's going to happen."
"You don't know that." She was still rigid, but he thought he heard a hint of doubt in her voice.
"I do."
He wiped a bead of sweat from his jaw.
"Listen, if I thought there was the slightest chance. But I didn't. I... God, Bree, I couldn't stand the thought of you being hurt."
She stood still, breathing heavily through her nose. If she'd had the choice, he was sure it would have been fire and brimstone rather than air.
"It wasn't your business to make up my mind for me," she said, speaking through clenched teeth, "no matter what you thought.
And about something so important.
Roger, how could you do something like that?"
The tone of betrayal in her voice was too much.
"Damn it! I was afraid if I told you you'd do just what you did," he burst out. "You'd leave me. You'd try to go through the stones by yourself. And now look what you've done. Here's the both of us in this godforsaken..."
"You're trying to blame me for you being here? When I did everything I possibly could to keep you from being such an idiot as to follow me?" Months of toil and terror, days of worry and fruitless searching caught up with Roger in a scorching blast.
"An idiot? That's the thanks I get for killing myself to find you? For risking my fucking life to try to protect you?"
He rose from the straw, meaning to get hold of her, not sure if he meant to shake her or bed her again. He had the chance to do neither. A hard shove caught him off balance square in the chest, and he went sprawling into the hay. She was hopping on one foot, cursing incoherently as she struggled into her breeches.
"You bloody arrogant! Damn you, Roger! Damn you!"
She jerked up the breeches, and leaning down, snatched up her shoes and stockings.
"Go," she said. "Damn you, go! Go and get hanged if you want to. I'm going to find my parents, and I'm going to save them too."
She whirled away, reached the door, and jerked it open before he could reach her. She stood for a moment, silhouetted in the paler square of the doorway, dark strands of hair afloat in the wind, live as the strands of Medusa's mane.
"I'm going. Come or don't come, I don't care. Go back to Scotland. Go back through the stones by yourself for all I care. But by God, you can't stop me."
And then she was gone. Lizzie's eyes shot wide as the door banged open against the wall. She hadn't been asleep. How could she sleep? But had been lying with her eyes closed. She struggled up out of the bedclothes and fumbled for the tinderbox.
"Are you all right, Miss Bree?"
It didn't sound like it. Brianna was stamping to and fro, hissing through her teeth like a snake, stopping to kick the wardrobe with a resounding thud. There were two more thuds in succession. By the wavering light of the newly lit candle, Lizzie could see that these were caused by Brianna's shoes, which had hit the wall and fallen to the floor.
"Are you all right?" she repeated uncertainly.
"Fine," said Brianna. From the black air beyond the window, a voice roared, "Brianna, I shall come for you. Do you hear me? I will come." Her mistress made no answer, but strode to the window, seized the shutters, and crashed them shut with a bang that made the room echo. Then she turned like a panther striking, and dashed the candlestick to the floor, plunging the room in suffocating dark. Lizzie eased herself back into bed, and lay frozen, afraid to move or speak. She could hear Brianna tearing off her clothes in silent frenzy, the hiss of indrawn breath punctuating the rustle of cloth and the stamp of bare feet on the wooden floor. Through the shutter, she heard outside the muffled sound of cursing, then nothing. She had seen Brianna's face for a moment in the light, white as paper and hard as bone, with the eyes black holes. Her gentle, kindly mistress had vanished like smoke, taken over by a Jowan, a she-devil. Lizzie was a town lass, born long after Culloden. She had never seen the wild clansmen of the glens or a Highlander in the grip of blood fury. But she'd heard the old stories, and now she knew them true. A person who looked like that might do anything at all. She tried to breathe as though she were sleeping, but the air came through her mouth in strangled gasps. Brianna seemed not to notice, though. She walked about the room in quick, hard steps, poured water in the bowl and splashed it on her face, then slid between the quilts and lay flat, rigid as a board. Summoning all her courage, she turned her head toward her mistress.
"Are you all right, Avalna Labatat?" she asked,
in a voice so low that her mistress could pretend not to have heard it if she wanted. For a moment she thought that Brianna meant to ignore her. Then, "Yes," came the answer, in a voice so flat and expressionless it didn't sound like Brianna's at all. "Go to sleep." She didn't, of course. A body didn't sleep, lying next to someone who might turn into an Ushka next thing. Her eyes had adjusted to the dark again, but she was afraid to look, in case the red hair lying on the pillow next to her should suddenly be a mane, and the delicate straight nose changed to a curved, soft muzzle over teeth that would rend and devour. It was a few moments before Lizzie realized that her mistress was trembling. Not weeping, there was no sound, but shaking hard enough to make the bedclothes rustle.
"Fool," she scolded herself. "It's no but your friend and your lady with something terrible that's happened to her, and you lying here snivelling over fancies."
On impulse, she rolled toward Brianna, reaching for the other girl's hand.
"Bree," she said softly, "can I be helping you at all, then?"
Brianna's hand curled round hers and squeezed, quick and hard, then let go.
"No," Brianna said very softly. "Go to sleep, Lizzie. Everything will be all right."
Lizzie took leave to doubt that, but said no more, lying back down and breathing quietly. It was a very long time, but at last Brianna's long body shuddered gently and relaxed into sleep. Lizzie couldn't sleep. With the fever gone again, she was alert and restless. The single quilt lay heavy and damp on her, and with the shutters closed, the air in the tiny room was like breathing hot molasses. Finally, unable to stand it any longer, Lizzie slid quietly out of bed. Keeping an ear out for any sound from the bed, she crept to the window and eased open the shutters. The air was still hot and muggy outside, but it had begun to move a little. The dawn breeze was coming, with the turn of air from sea to land. It was still dark, but the sky had begun to lighten as well. She could make out the line of the road below, blessedly empty. Not knowing what else to do, she did what she always did when troubled or confused, set about to make things tidy. Moving quietly about the room, she picked up the clothes Brianna had so violently discarded and shook them out. They were filthy,
covered with streaks of leaf stain and dirt, riddled with bits of straw. She could see it even in the dim light from the window. What had Brianna been doing, rolling about on the ground? The instant the thought came into her head, she saw it in her mind so plain that the notion froze her with shock. Brianna, pinned to the ground, struggling with the black devil who had taken her away. Her mistress was a fine big woman, but Jon Mackenzie was a great tall brute of a man. He could have... She stopped herself abruptly, not wanting to imagine. She couldn't help it, though. Her mind had gone too far already. With great reluctance, she brought the shirt to her nose and sniffed. Yes, there it was, the reek of a man, strong and sour as the smell of a rutting goat. The thought of the wicked creature with his body pressed to Brianna's, rubbing against her, leaving his scent on her like a dog who marks his ground. She shuddered in revulsion. Trembling, she snatched up the breeches and stockings and bore all the clothes to the basin. She would wash them out, rinse away the reminder of Mackenzie with the dirt and the grass stains. And if the clothes were too wet for her mistress to wear in the morning, well, so much the better for that. She still had the pot of soft yellow lye soap the landlady had given her for laundering. That would take care of it. She plunged the breeks into the water, added a finger's dollop of the soap, and began to work it into a scummy lather, pressing it through and through the fabric. The window square was lightening. She cast a stealthy glance over her shoulder at her mistress. But Brianna's breath came slow and steady. Good. She wouldn't wait for a time yet. She looked back to her work and froze, feeling a chill colder than those that came with her fevers. The thin suds that covered her hands were dark, and small black eddies spread through the water like the ink stains of a cuttlefish. She didn't want to look, but it was too late to pretend she hadn't seen. She turned back the wet fabric carefully, and there it was, a large dark blotch discoloring the cloth just where the seams crossed in the crotch of the breeks. The rising sun oozed a sullen red through the hazy sky, turning the water in the basin, the air in the room, the whole spinning world, the colour of fresh blood. Chapter 41 Journey's End. Brianna thought she might scream. Instead, she patted Lizzie's back and spoke softly. "Don't worry. It'll be all right. Mr. Vjost says he'll wait for us. As soon as you feel better, we'll leave. But for now, don't worry about anything. Just rest." Lizzie nodded, but couldn't answer. Her teeth were chattering too hard, in spite of the three blankets over her and the hot brick at her feet. "I'll go and get your drink, honey. Just rest," Brianna repeated, and with a final pat, rose and left the room. It wasn't Lizzie's fault, of course, Brianna thought, but she could scarcely have picked a worse moment to have another attack of fever. Brianna had slept late and restlessly after the dreadful scene with Roger, waking to find her clothes washed and hung to dry, her shoes polished, her stockings folded, the room ruthlessly swept and tidied, and Lizzie collapsed in a shivering heap on the empty hearth. For the thousandth time she counted the days, 8 days until Monday. If Lizzie's attack followed its usual pattern, she might be able to travel the day after tomorrow, 6 days. And according to Junior Smoots and Hans Vjost, 5 to 6 days to make the trip upriver at this time of year. She couldn't miss Jamie Fraser. She couldn't. She had to be in Cross Creek by Monday, come hell or high water. Who knew how long the trial might take, or whether he would leave as soon as it was over? She would have given anything to be able to go at once. The burning ache to move, to go, was so intense it obliterated all the other aches and burnings of her body, even the deep heart-burning of Roger's betrayal. But there was nothing to be done. She could go nowhere until Lizzie was better. The tap-room was full. 2 new ships had come into the harbour during the day, and now, at evening, the benches were full of seamen, with a game of cards loud and lively at the table in the corner. Brianna edged through the blue clouds of tobacco smoke, ignoring the whistles and ribald remarks. Roger had wanted her to wear a dress, had he? Damn him! Her breeches normally kept men at a safe distance,
but Lizzie had washed them, and they were still too damp to wear. She gave one man, who reached for her buttocks, a glare fit to sear his eyebrows. He stopped in mid-grab, startled, and she slid by him, through the door to the kitchen breezeway. On the way back, with the jug of steaming catmint tea wrapped in a cloth to keep from burning her, she made a detour around the edge of the room to avoid her would-be assailant. If he touched her, she would pour boiling water in his lap, and while that would be no more than he deserved and some palliative to her own volcanic feelings, it would waste the tea which Lizzie badly needed. She stepped carefully sideways, squeezing between the raucous card players and the wall. The table was scattered with coins and other small valuables, silver and gilt and pewter buttons, a snuff box, a silver penknife, and scribbled scraps of paper. IOUs, she supposed, or the 18th century equivalent. Then one of the men moved, and beyond his shoulder she caught the gleam of gold. She glanced down, looked away, then looked back, startled. It was a ring, a plain gold band, but wider than most. It wasn't the gold alone that had caught her eye, though. The ring was no more than a foot away, and while the light in the tap room was more than dim, a candlestick sat on the card player's table, shedding its light in the inner curve of the golden band. She couldn't quite read the letters engraved there, but she knew the pattern so well that the legend sprang into her mind unbidden. She laid a hand on the shoulder of the man who had the ring, interrupting him in mid-jest. He turned, half frowning, the frown clearing as he saw who had touched him. "Aye, sweetheart, and have you come to change my luck, then?" He was a big man, with a heavy-boned, handsome face, a broad mouth, and a broken nose, and a pair of light green eyes that moved over her with quick appraisal. She forced her lips to smile at him. "I hope so," she said. "Shall I give your ring a rub for luck?" Without waiting for permission, she snatched the ring from the table and gave it a brisk rub on her sleeve. Then, holding it up to admire the shine, she could see plainly the words written inside. "From F to C, with love, always." Her hand was trembling as she gave it back. "It's very pretty," she said. "Where did you get it?" He looked startled, then wary, and she hastened to add, "It's too small for you. Won't your wife be angry if you lose her ring?" "How?" she thought wildly. "How did he get it? And what's happened to my mother?" The full lips curved in a charming smile. "And if I had a wife, sweetheart, sure I'd leave her for you." He looked her over more closely, long lashes dropping to hide his gaze. He touched her waist in a casual gesture of invitation. "I'm busy just now, sweetheart, but later, eh?" The jug was burning through the cloth, but her fingers felt cold. Her heart had congealed into a small lump of terror. "Tomorrow," she said, "in the daylight." He looked at her, startled, then threw his head back and laughed. "Well, I've heard men say I'm not a one to be met in the dark, Poppet, but the women seem to prefer it." He ran a thick finger down her forearm in play. The red-gold hairs rose at his touch. "In the daylight, then, if you like. Come to my ship, Gloriana, near the naval yard." "Gracious! You will not how long have eaten?" Miss Viorst peered at Brianna's empty bowl with good-willed incredulity. About the same age as Brianna herself, she was a broad-built, placid-tempered Dutchwoman, whose motherly manner made her seem a good deal older. "Day before yesterday, I think." Brianna gratefully accepted a second helping of dumplings and broth, and yet another thick slab of salt-rising bread, slathered with curls of fresh white butter. "Oh, thank you." The food did something to fill the hollow space that yawned inside her. A small warm comfort around which to center herself. Lizzie's fever had come on again 2 days upriver. This time the attack was longer and more severe, and Brianna had been seriously afraid that Lizzie would die right there in the middle of the Cape Fear River. She had sat in mid-canoe for all of a day and a night, while Viorst and his partner paddled like maniacs, she alternately pouring handfuls of water over Lizzie's head and wrapping her in all the coats and blankets available, all the time praying to see the girl's small bosom rise with the next breath.
"If I die, will you tell my father?"
Lizzie had whispered to her in the rushing dark.
"I will, but you won't, so dinner fash yourself," Brianna said firmly.
It was successful. Lizzie's frail back quivered with laughter at Brianna's attempted Scots, and a small bony hand reached up to hers, holding on until sleep loosened its grip and the fleshless fingers slipped free. Vjorst, alarmed at Lizzie's state, had taken her to the house he shared with his sister a little way below Cross Creek, carrying Lizzie's blanket-wrapped body up the dusty trail from the river to a small framed cottage. The girl's stubborn spirit had brought her through once more, but Brianna thought that the fragile flesh might not be equal to many more such demands. She cut a dumpling in half and ate it slowly, savouring the rich, warm juices of chicken and onion. She was grubby, travel-worn, starved and exhausted, every bone in her body aching. They had made it, though. They were in Cross Creek, and tomorrow was Monday. Somewhere nearby was Jamie Fraser, and, God willing, Claire as well. She touched the leg of her breeches and the secret pocket sewn into the seam. It was still there, the small round hardness of the talisman. Her mother was still alive. That was all that mattered. After eating, she went once more to check on Lizzie. Hanukkah-Vjorst was sitting by the bed darning socks. She nodded to Brianna, smiling.
"She is good."
Looking down at the wasted, sleeping face, Brianna wouldn't have said that much. Still, the fever was gone. A hand on Lizzie's brow came away cool and damp, and a half-empty bowl on the table nearby showed that she had managed a little nourishment.
"You will rest, too."
Hanukkah half rose, gesturing toward the trundle bed pulled out in readiness. Brianna cast a glance of longing at the clean quilts and puffy bolster, but shook her head.
"Not yet, thank you. What I'd really like is to borrow your mule, if I might."
There was no telling where Jamie Fraser was now. Vjorst had told her that River Run was a good distance from the town. He might be there, or he might be staying somewhere in Cross Creek, for convenience. She couldn't leave Lizzie long enough to ride all the way to River Run, but she did want to go into town and find the courthouse where the trial would be held tomorrow. She was taking no chance of missing him by not knowing where to go. The mule was large and elderly, but not averse to ambling along the riverbank road. He walked somewhat slower than she could have done herself, but that didn't matter. She was in no hurry now. Despite her tiredness, she began to feel better as she rode, her bruised, stiff body relaxing into the easy rhythm of the mule's slow gait. It was a hot, humid day, but the sky was clear and blue, and great elms and hickory trees overhung the road, cool leaves filtering the sun. Torn between Lizzie's illness and her own painful memories, she had noticed nothing of the second half of their voyage, taken no notice of change in the countryside they passed. Now it was like being magically transported during sleep, waking up in a different place. She put everything else aside, determined to forget the last few days and everything in them. She was going to find Jamie Fraser. The sandy roads, scrub pine forests and marshy swamps of the coast were gone, replaced by thickets of cool green, by tall, thick-trunked canopied trees, and a soft orange dirt that darkened to black mould where the dead leaves lay matted at the edge of the road. The shrieks of gulls and terns were gone, replaced by the muted chatter of a jay and the soft, liquid song of a whippoorwill far back in the forest. How would it be? She wondered. She had wondered the same thing 100 times, and 100 times imagined different scenes. What she would say, what he would say. Would he be glad to see her? She hoped so, and yet he would be a stranger. Likely he would bear no resemblance at all to the man of her imagination. With some difficulty she fought back the memory of Lyra's voice. A liar and a cheat. Her mother hadn't thought so.
"Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof," she murmured to herself. She had come into the town of Cross Creek itself. The scattered houses thickened, and the dirt track widened into a cobbled street lined with shops and larger houses. There were people about, but it was the hottest part of the afternoon, when the air lay still and heavy on the town. Those who could be were inside in the shade. The road curved out following the river bank. A small sawmill stood by itself on a point of land, and near it a tavern. She'd ask there, she decided. Hot as it was, she could use something to drink. She patted the pocket of her coat to be sure she had money. She felt instead the prickly outline of a horse chestnut's hull, and pulled her hand away as though she'd been burned. She felt hollow again, in spite of the food she'd eaten. Lips pressed tight together, she tethered the mule and ducked into the dark refuge of the tavern. The room was empty, save for the landlord, perched in somnolence on his stool. He roused himself at her step, and after the usual goggle of surprise at her appearance, served her beer and gave her courteous directions to the courthouse. "Thank you." She wiped the sweat from her forehead with a coat sleeve. Even inside, the heat was stifling.
"You'll have come for the trial, then?"
the landlord ventured, still looking at her curiously. "Yes. Well, not really. Whose trial is it?" she asked, belatedly realizing that she had no idea.
"Oh, it'll be Fergus Fraser,"
the man said, as though assuming that naturally everyone knew who Fergus Fraser was.
"Assault on an officer of the Crown is the charge. You'll be acquitted, though," the landlord went on matter-of-factly. "Jamie Fraser's come down from the mountain for him."
Brianna choked on her beer.
"You know Jamie Fraser?"
she asked breathlessly, swabbing at the spilled foam on her sleeve. The landlord's brows went up.
"Wait but a moment, you'll know him too."
He nodded at a pewter tankard full of beer sitting on the nearby table. She hadn't noticed it when she came in.
"He went out the back just as you came in. Hey!
He fell back with a cry of surprise as she dropped her own tankard on the floor and shot out the back door like a bat out of hell. The light outside was dazzling after the taproom's gloom. Brianna blinked, eyes tearing at the shafts of sun that stabbed through the shifting greens of a screen of maples. Then a movement caught her eye below the flickering leaves. He stood in the shade of the maples, half turned away from her, head bent in absorption. A tall man, long-legged, lean and graceful, with his shoulders broad under a white shirt. He wore a faded kilt in pale greens and browns, casually wrapped up in front as he urinated against a tree. He finished, and letting the kilt fall, turned toward the post-house. He saw her then, standing there staring at him, and tense slightly, hands half-curling. Then he saw past her men's clothes, and the look of wary suspicion changed at once to surprise as he realized that she was a woman. There was no doubt in her mind from the first glimpse. She was at once surprised and not surprised at all. He wasn't quite what she had imagined. He seemed smaller, only man-sized, but his face had the lines of her own, the long, straight nose and stubborn jaw, and the slanted cat eyes set in a frame of solid bone. He moved toward her out of the maple's shadow, and the sun struck his hair with a spray of copper sparks. Half-consciously, she raised a hand and pushed a strand of hair back from her face, seeing from the corner of her eye the matching gleam of thick red gold.
"What do you want here, lassie?" he asked.
"Sharp, but not unkind." His voice was deeper than she had imagined, the Highland burr slight but distinct.
"You," she blurted.
Her heart seemed to have wedged itself in her throat. She had trouble forcing any words past it. He was close enough that she caught the faint whiff of his sweat and the fresh smell of sawn wood. There was a golden scatter of sawdust caught in the rolled sleeves of his linen shirt. His eyes narrowed with amusement as he looked her up and down, taking in her costume. One reddish eyebrow rose, and he shook his head.
"Sorry, lass," he said, with a half-smile. "I'm a married man."
He made to pass by, and she made a small incoherent sound, putting out a hand to stop him, but not quite daring to touch his sleeve. He stopped and looked at her more closely.
"No, I mean it. I've a wife at home, and home's not far," he said, evidently wishing to be courteous. "But..."
He stopped, close enough now to take in the grubbiness of her clothes, the hole in the sleeve of her coat, and the tattered ends of her stock.
"Oh," he said, in a different tone,
and reached for the small leather purse he wore tied at his waist.
"Will you be starved then, lass? I've money if you must eat."
She could scarcely breathe. His eyes were dark blue, soft with kindness. Her eyes fixed on the open collar of his shirt where the curly hairs showed, bleached gold against his sunburnt skin.
"Are you... you're Jamie Fraser, aren't you?"
He glanced sharply at her face.
"I am," he said.
The wariness had returned to his face. His eyes narrowed against the sun. He glanced quickly behind him toward the tavern, but nothing stirred in the open doorway. He took a step closer to her.
"Who asks?" he said softly. "Have you a message for me, lass?"
She felt an absurd desire to laugh welling up in her throat. Did she have a message?
"My name is Brianna," she said.
He frowned, uncertain, and something flickered in his eyes. He knew it. He'd heard the name, and it meant something to him. She swallowed hard, feeling her cheeks blaze as though they'd been seared by a candle flame.
"I'm your daughter," she said,
her voice sounding choked to her own ears.
"Brianna."
He stood stock still, not changing expression in the slightest. He had heard her, though. He went pale, and then a deep, painful red washed up his throat and into his face, sudden as a brush fire, matching her own vivid colour. She felt a deep flash of joy at the sight, a rush through her midsection that echoed that blaze of blood, recognition of their kinship. Did it trouble him to blush so strongly, she wondered suddenly. Had he schooled his face to immobility, as she had learned to do, to mask that telltale surge? Her own face felt stiff, but she gave him a tentative smile. He blinked, and his eyes moved at last from her face, slowly taking in her appearance, and, with what seemed to her a new and horrified awareness, her height.
"My God," he croaked, "you're huge!"
Her own blush had subsided, but now came back with a vengeance.
"And whose fault is that, do you think?" she snapped.
She drew herself up straight and squared her shoulders, glaring. So close, at her full height, she could look him right in the eye, and did. He jerked back, and his face did change then, mask shattering in surprise. Without it, he looked younger. Underneath were shock, surprise, and a dawning expression of half-painful eagerness.
"Och, no, lassie," he exclaimed. "I didn't mean it that way at all. It's only..."
He broke off, staring at her in fascination. His hand lifted, as though despite himself, and traced the air, outlining her cheek, her jaw, and neck and shoulder, afraid to touch her directly.
"It's true," he whispered. "It is you, Brianna."
He spoke her name with a queer accent.
"Brianna."
And she shivered at the sound.
"It's me," she said, a little huskily.
She made another attempt at a smile.
"Can't you tell?"
His mouth was wide and full-lipped, but not like hers. Wider, a bolder shape that seemed to hide a smile in the corners of it, even in repose.
It was twitching now, not certain what to do. "Aye," he said. "Aye, I can."
He did touch her then, his fingers drawing lightly down her face, brushing back the waves of ruddy hair from temple and ear, tracing the delicate line of her jaw. She shivered again, though his touch was noticeably warm. She could feel the heat of his palm against her cheek.
"I hadn't a thought of you as grown," he said, letting his hand fall reluctantly away.
I saw the pictures, but still, I had you in my mind somehow as a wee bairn always.